The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Shell. And today we're talking about the seemingly never-ending debates surrounding bioethics and public policy. My guest, Ronald A. Lindsay, is by training and experience both a lawyer and a philosopher. After graduating from the University of Virginia School of Law, he practiced for 26 years with the national law firm Seyfarth Shaw LLP prior to joining the Center for Inquiry, where he's been president and CEO since June 2008. He has a PhD specializing in bioethics, and his book, Future Bioethics, Overcoming Taboos, Myths, and Dogmas, was published by Prometheus Books in June 2008. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Ron.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure being here.
Now, what I liked about your book is that you've provided a framework for how to think about bioethics and public policy. So why is creating policy on bioethical issues so different than other kinds of policy?
Because they're novel questions to a large extent. These are questions that, until recent times, within the past 50 or so years, have really rarely been encountered, at least not at the level of frequency in which they're encountered now. I mean, past generations did not have to confront stem cell research. The question of assistance in dying or euthanasia certainly was known before the last 50 or 100 years, but in terms of the demand for it, that's something new. It's caused, of course, by the fact that now we can prolong life much better than we did before, which has created, as a consequence, the fact that some people don't want to live as long as they possibly can with medical technology. There are these new problems that come about, and we have to think about them seriously. Stock answers that we may have given to problems in the past simply don't apply, or don't apply at least without some reasoning, some careful reasoning about these issues.
And also these issues definitely are accompanied by some kind of moral component.
Yes. Obviously, to frame public policy on issues like this, it's informed by morality. Again, our morality was formed under conditions where these new technologies were not available. One has to think about how our moral norms might apply in a setting, for example, where suddenly we have the prospect of enhancements to our intelligence or enhancements to our physical abilities, something that, again, past generations did not have to consider.
Well, how can you argue with somebody else's moral beliefs? I think that's the problem. How can you do that effectively?
Well, let me start by saying I think there is a widely shared morality. Sometimes that's obscured by the fact that, I mean, it's undeniable we have moral disagreements, but those disagreements stand out because they're the exceptions. Most of the time we're in a rough consensus about what we should do. A simple example is the fact that we expect people to live up to their commitments, and most of the time they do. We couldn't get through one day in our lives unless most people, most of the time, live up to their commitments. Whether it's someone who gathers the news for you in the morning and you read it on your tablet, you expect it to be there. You don't expect suddenly it not to be there. If you go to the metro station, you expect the trains to be running most of the time. You go to the office, you expect most of your colleagues to be there most of the time. And so on and so on. So we rely on people to keep commitments, and that itself is part of morality. The understanding that people, if they've said they're going to do something, they will actually follow through and do it. And the same thing with our interaction with people. Most of the time we expect people to tell the truth, and most of the time they do tell the truth. So we have this background morality that governs a lot of our ordinary discourse and interaction with each other. And then we come to problem cases where we might think a little differently. And in those problem cases, we first of all have to make sure we have our facts right, because sometimes moral disputes are due to disagreement about the facts. Once you get the facts straight, you have to think about the implications of your moral norms or moral rules. And specifically, are they being applied consistently? Is there some inconsistency that would result in resolving the dispute? And you also have to look at the underlying rationale of the rules. And this is where I think most people fall down, because unfortunately most people tend to think of ethics as something that's kind of given to them. That's especially true with people who have a religious orientation. not saying it's true of all religious people, and I'm not saying secular people sometimes don't have this as well, but there's this mentality that ethics is like a set of rules, you know, Ten Commandments or something else, or if you're a secular person, maybe something that someone indoctrinated in you, and that's it. And you can apply these rigidly, and there are no exceptions, and that's what morality is all about. And that's really not true. Morality is a way to enable us to live together, and in doing so also to ameliorate harmful conditions. That's essentially, I mean, morality is a practical tool. And when we think of morality in that way, if we think about the underlying rationale of the rules, what's the purpose of the norms that we accept? What are we trying to do with them? I think that's a way we can resolve some of our disputes.
Well, especially when we're talking about public policy, you mentioned harms. So it's a bit of a cost-benefit analysis then.
It is. I mean, obviously, you have to weigh the consequences. And I'm not a utilitarian in the sense that I think there's, you know, some utilitarians would say there's one unique right answer because there's some way to actually calculate interpersonal benefits and harms, and you can come up with just the right answer. I don't think morality is susceptible to such precise calculation. On the other hand, I do think that you can give a kind of rough assessment of what the consequences are, and using that rough assessment, balance the harms and the benefits.
So what exactly would we base that on then?
There are certain things that people recognize as harmful. Pain, generally speaking, is a bad thing. I mean, that's something that is universally recognized as a bad thing. People don't like to experience pain. And therefore, they recognize if they live together in peace with other people, they should refrain from inflicting pain on other people. I mean, sometimes we endure pain for a greater good. We may go to the dentist to get our teeth drilled, but that's because we want to avoid, you know, worse pain down the road. But generally, you know, pain is recognized as a bad thing. A loss of opportunity is recognized as a bad thing. Being deprived of freedom, the ability to pursue a job, the ability to marry someone that you want to marry, the right to decide whether or not to have a child. These are things that people regard as, if they're deprived of them, as harms, and if they have the ability to exercise their choice, as benefits. Autonomy in general, the ability to give shape and direction in one's life, is something, again, that is almost universally valued.
But again, this is where it gets complicated, because if we're talking about harm, one potential harm can easily seem greater than a dozen potential benefits.
That's true. And there you have to tease out exactly the implications rather than relying, as I say, on some stock rule or something that you think has, you know, absolute validity. You have to try to figure out, well, what's the rationale behind the rule? I mean, just to give you an easy example, the one often used in philosophy classes. I said it before, it's universally recognized that telling truth is a good thing. We rely on people to tell the truth. If we didn't do that most of the time, we couldn't carry out our lives, right? Because we couldn't rely on other people, society would fall apart, et cetera, et cetera. But the purpose of truth telling is not some abstract rule or filling some abstract norm just for the sake of doing it. It's, again, it serves a practical purpose. It allows us to live together and cooperate and reciprocate and rely on one another. But there are certain circumstances where telling the truth would actually cause harm and would not be the thing to do. And, you know, the white lies are a common example. If you have someone, you know, an uncle who just maybe is on his deathbed or something, but he wants to be cheered up, you can tell that, and he's asking you how he looks, and maybe he looks like hell, but is there any point in telling him he looks horrible, right? There's
right.
No point in telling him you look ugly and you have stuff dripping from your eyes. No, right, you say, hey, you look fine, you're cool, you know, right? What purpose would be served in that case by telling the truth?
So,
in other words, don't make a fetish or obsession of the moral norms. I mean, they're very important,
right?
But you have to apply them intelligently.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Ronald A. Lindsay, author of Future Bioethics. Okay, let's look at an example, euthanasia. How do we use the framework that sort of you've laid out and we just spoke about to look at public policy on that? Where do we start?
Here I think we have what seems to be a conflict between two core norms. All societies recognize that killing is bad. Again, there are certain exceptions that people think of, but in general, killing someone's a bad thing. again, for obvious reasons. You can't have any society in which killing is permitted indiscriminately. On the other hand, pain, as I said, is a bad thing. Suffering is a bad thing. People also value autonomy. They like to have control over their own lives. So what do you do in a situation like this? And we're talking here, of course, about voluntary euthanasia. Or I actually prefer the example of assistance in dying. Let me talk about assistance in dying first, which is a little different. This is the model that's used in Oregon and Washington, where you have a physician write out a prescription for a terminally ill patient after the patient has established that they're competent to make their wishes known and act on them. And then the patient can, if they decide their suffering is too much, take this lethal barbiturate and end their lives. It's often called assisted suicide. Other people call it assisted dying. What are the arguments against that? Well, the principal argument is the sanctity of life argument, that somehow the doctor or the people who cooperate with this patient are complicit in this person ending her or his own life, and that's a bad thing because we value life. But if you look at the underlying rationale of the rule against killing, obviously we have the rule against killing because it's almost always regarded as a harm because people want to live. They have things to do. They want to raise a family. They want to get married. They want to write a book. Whatever, all the different ambitions that people have in life. Life is a good thing. Everyone recognizes that. But there can come a point in time, especially if one is terminally ill and one recognizes that one may only have a couple months, maybe a couple weeks to live. If one is in pain and in suffering, then the harm of that pain outweighs the benefit of living, especially if one is so incapacitated that one really can't do anything. And in the case of the terminally ill people, especially in the latter stages, many of them are bedridden or immobile. They're really unable to carry out any of the functions of life. In those circumstances, how would we apply the rule against killing? The normal rationale doesn't apply there, because here, the person that, we supposedly are prevented from killing wants to die, moreover, clearly has some reason to want to accelerate their death because they're suffering. And in those circumstances, we should respect that person's autonomy. That's a moral case for saying assistance in dying is okay. Here, I think an important thing is to distinguish between morality and legality, because one could argue that, okay, it's moral to assist a person who's in pain and suffering, whether we do it by giving them a pill or maybe taking some more direct action by giving them an injection or something else. One of the arguments against legalization, though, is that that's too dangerous, because maybe in certain cases it would be the morally right thing to do, but by legalizing it, we expose other people to dangers. And that's not a sanctity of life argument, rather it's an argument based on the adverse consequences of legalization, and it's an argument that has to be considered seriously. And that's one reason I distinguish between assistance in dying and euthanasia, because although I think, based on the experience in Oregon and also now in Washington, we can legalize assistance in dying without any adverse consequences, I'm not entirely convinced that's the case with euthanasia. The distinction there being that in assistance in dying, the patient controls the last act. So in Oregon and Washington, for example, the patient has to decide to take the lethal medication.
Right.
In euthanasia, you're leaving it up, typically it would be to the doctor, maybe some other healthcare provider, to make the decision. And that's putting an awful lot of power into the hands of a physician or another healthcare provider. And based on the experience in the Netherlands, when it first became legal, there were some abuses. Abuses in the sense that there were some cases of non-voluntary euthanasia. People were killed, and it wasn't entirely clear that they had made an express request for that type of assistance.
Hmm.
That indicates there are some dangers to that. So I'm actually a moderate on this issue in the sense that I believe both assisted dying and euthanasia may be moral, depending on the case. In terms of legalization, I'm in favor of legalizing assistance in dying based on the Oregon model. I'm undecided and probably leaning against legalizing euthanasia. At least at this stage, I think there's a credible argument can be made. It may expose some patients to the risk of a death that they really don't want.
Well, there's another interesting argument that's sort of related to that. If physician assistance in dying was legalized, that it could lead to the quality of healthcare for the terminally ill deteriorating.
Right. There were a set of arguments that were made by opponents of legalization of assistance in dying that were not tied to the sanctity of life.
Right.
Although the sanctity of life thing really is, I think, the one that motivates most of the people who are opposed to legalization. But there are some people who are secular who were legitimately concerned about a set of things. One was the what I've indicated are possible abuses where maybe someone would be pressured into requesting it. And another one was that the quality of health care for the terminally ill would deteriorate because the attitude would be, well, why bother giving them assistance because they're going to be dead soon anyway, and you know, why aren't they requesting the pill? You know, they should be requesting the pill instead of asking us to continue supporting them with these machines and things. Before the law went into effect in Oregon, you couldn't really say whether the argument really had great weight or not. I mean, it was speculation on both sides. Now that we have over a decade worth of the data from Oregon, it's clear, at least in the Northwest, in Oregon and Washington, where it's been legal, that hasn't proven to be the case. If anything, the quality of health care in Oregon is now better than it was. Quality of health care for the terminally ill, that is better than it was pre-legalization. In part, and this is actually something that a number of people, including myself, predicted, because there are people who are concerned about abuses and are actually are opposed to assistance in dying, they will actually increase their efforts to improve palliative care, especially, so that they won't use assistance in dying. And in fact, that's been the case. Hospice has become much more widely available now in Oregon than it was in the 80s and early 90s before legalization. And pain medication is much more freely available than it was before. So the track record that we have indicates that far from deteriorating, the quality of health care for the terminally ill actually improves after legalization because there are people who are concerned about this issue and want to make sure that people don't too hastily request that legal prescription.
Now, this is an interesting case because with euthanasia, with physician-assisted, legal-assisted dying, we do have the ability to look at the data around this,
right.
And we
right.
don't have that ability with a lot of other bioethical issues.
That's true. This is something now where we have, as I said, a record in the United States. It's in Oregon and Washington. It's Oregon since 1997, Washington just in the last 2 years. Netherlands, it's been legal in different ways. First, it was just case law exception, then eventually had a statute, but it's been legal essentially for 30 years. Belgium, a little less time. Same with Luxembourg. So we can look at the cases, the empirical data that's been compiled, and that helps to inform our judgments. Not really true with other issues, for example, the question of enhancements, which we may be talking about later.
Mm-hmm.
There are some enhancements that people are using already, but in terms of certainly widespread availability of enhancements that would radically change someone's intelligence or physical capabilities, by now it's just speculation. So we're basing our judgments on projections as opposed to empirical information, which is one reason sometimes these arguments are hard to resolve. It's a lot easier when you have the facts and you can point to empirical information to support one argument or the other.
But that being said, now that we do have empirical evidence, have the arguments changed at all?
I think they have.
Oh, good.
To some extent. The sanctity of life argument is going to remain because
right.
that's the bedrock principle. A lot of religious people have it. The case of Massachusetts actually shows that that is Massachusetts. This is in November for your listeners in case they weren't aware of it. Actually had a referendum on whether to adopt assistance in dying on the Oregon model. In other words, it'd be available to the terminally ill, the physician could write a prescription, et cetera, et cetera. A few weeks before the election, a poll showed overwhelming support for that. The number like 60% were going to be in favor of it. The Catholic Church and other religious groups then mounted a multi-million dollar advertising campaign talking about how horrible this law would be, and it was narrowly defeated 51-49. So most of the opposition is still based on the sanctity of life. People will still make arguments about the quality of health care will suffer, but that's really not an argument supported by empirical information. It's a bad argument. Same thing with there was an argument about slippery slope concerns that once you legalize assisted dying, it would lead to consensual killing being recognized. That hasn't happened. Or to non-voluntary euthanasia. That hasn't happened. And there's no indication it's going to happen. There's no push in Oregon, for example, to legalize non-voluntary euthanasia or anything along those lines. there's still opposition, and some people will still try to make an empirical argument, but the facts simply don't support them.
This is Skeptically Speaking. We'll be back to talk more with lawyer and philosopher Ronald A. Lindsay about bioethics and public policy after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm discussing bioethics and public policy with Ronald A. Lindsay, president and CEO of the Center for Inquiry and author of Future Bioethics: Overcoming Taboos, Myths, and Dogmas. A bioethical issue that is absolutely always in the news is public policy around genetically modified organisms. And we have spoken about GMOs on the show countless times. And I think the part that we don't talk about enough, actually, is ethics. So how would you approach the GMO issue?
How I would approach it is part of ethics, as we talked about for is making sure you have the right factual information to inform your ethical judgment. In the case of GMOs, it's important to have the right scientific information about what dangers GMOs may pose, because ultimately this is a question of risk assessment. Do GMOs pose such a significant risk to the public that we should ban them or regulate them more tightly than we have? And so look at the information that's available. The information that is available, and there have been a number of studies now done by, for example, the National Academy of Sciences, is that genetically modified produce doesn't pose any danger in terms of consumption. And in terms of other dangers, they'd be mostly speculative at this stage. You can always imagine some scenario where some harm might occur that we haven't thought of, but that isn't really a basis for regulation. Some people will invoke what's called the precautionary principle, which essentially is a principle that if something could cause harm and you can't prove that it won't cause harm, then it should be prohibited. And that is one principle that's often invoked in the discussion about GMOs. It's invoked by those who think we should ban genetically modified food. The problem with that is it's an overly cautious approach to new technology. If we had applied that, for example, in the case of vaccines, we never would have had the polio vaccine. That was something that really had not been field tested adequately, certainly by today's standards. There were some risks involved, and in fact, some people were harmed by the vaccine, but it provided an overwhelming benefit for the vast majority of people. And there are other examples one can think of. So it's really, as I said, a question of risk assessment. And the risk assessment I would apply is there's certainly no basis for an outright ban on genetically modified food.
Well, there seem to be two different issues that people conflate when we're talking about GM foods or GMOs altogether, actually. The ethical or not behavior of corporations and the soundness of the science. But when we're talking about public policy, there's a lot of overlap, isn't there?
There is. As you just said, there are two issues, and those are two distinct issues. And I think in framing public policy, we have to make sure that we're not conflating them, because one can certainly be in favor, and I am, again, based on the science, of allowing genetically modified organisms to be developed, to be cultivated. They've been done that way successfully now, I think, for a couple of decades, especially in the United States, but in other countries as well. It's a separate question as to whether we should allow private corporations to have so much control, for example, over seed production. which may be an issue. There is certainly some danger in having a handful of companies control most of the seed that's used by farmers throughout the world. But one of the ironies is in this situation is that there's actually so much regulation right now involved in the production of genetically modified organisms. It's actually a barrier to smaller companies to enter fields like this because they don't have the economic resources to undergo years of waiting to have their produce tested to make sure it's safe. So you have, the field is dominated by a few giants like Monsanto, in part because of the burdens of regulation.
On that note, a listener, Don Peterson, sent us an email after the last episode on GMOs that we did. He made some interesting points. He wrote, Monsanto doesn't just sue those who have bought their seeds and saved them. They sue farmers whose crops have acquired the genes through inadvertent contamination in seed cleaning businesses. And I had not heard of this. So is that correct? Companies can sue for accidental introduction?
That is not what Monsanto claims. It's what some of the farmers claim. There was a movie called Food Incorporated, which I happened to see, and had a very moving case. It seemed to be a very moving case about Monsanto pursuing some farmers who claimed that they had some of their crop contaminated by a genetically modified corn, I think it was in this case, might have been soybean. And Monsanto was claiming that they had used their seed, and therefore Monsanto could proceed against them because these seeds are considered intellectual property, if you will. They're developed by Monsanto. Monsanto has intellectual property protection, and you have to purchase their seed, and you sign an agreement when you do that, et cetera, et cetera. It's considered illegal if you plant Monsanto seed or seeds from DuPont. That's another big company in this area, or Syngenta. So these farmers were claiming they were innocent. Turned out that at least one of the farmers in that case, as turned out now after years of litigation, he admitted he had actually acquired some Monsanto seed improperly and had been planting it. So, in fact, the lawsuit had a basis in fact. This is one of the cases that was documented in this movie. But get back to your question. If in fact the farmers can prove that this contamination was accidental, well, there's no liability on their part. Well, what Monsanto is claiming is that these farmers are in fact trying to cultivate their crops using Monsanto's product. It's a factual question that has to be determined by the courts.
I want to just speak really briefly about labeling GM foods, because you mentioned it in the book. So if we're talking about public policy, isn't labeling just a compromise between the two somewhat extreme camps sometimes?
I'm actually of two minds with this, and I can see an argument for labeling in the sense that don't we want people to have information? Why, though, would we label something? What's the underlying purpose of labeling? Presumably it's to provide information, especially about risks, right? If you have a peanut allergy, for example, everyone, you've seen the labels, they talk about may contain peanut products or other types of products that people may be allergic to. Well, that's good because obviously we don't want people to have a adverse reaction to something they're consuming. So labeling is good in that sense. We also now have labeling about nutritional values, how many calories something has, how much fat it contains, et cetera, et cetera. If you say it's something genetically modified, you're not really passing on any relevant scientific information. You're essentially appealing to a prejudice that people may have because, again, the science has established if you're consuming a genetically modified item, corn, soybean, it's no different in chemical composition than some corn or soybean product that wasn't genetically modified. In other words, what you're consuming is the same. It's the process by which it was produced is different. The most common genetic modification for corn is called something BT corn. And what it is, they insert into the corn a pesticide, essentially, that will kill one of the most common pests, the corn borer. That doesn't affect ultimately the composition of the corn that you're eating, corn on the cob or cornbread or what have you. It's going to be the same thing whether it had this genetic modification or not. So the argument against labeling, which I think has some strength, is you're just essentially pandering to this fear that people have, irrational fear, that there's something they need to be on guard against, when in fact there's nothing they have to be on guard against.
Right, but the idea that, again, looking at harm versus benefit, is it more harmful long-term that we label, or is it more harmful that the people are going to continue to be concerned? If the issue is the labeling will just make people feel better, knowing that they have that information so they can make their consumer decisions, is that not enough?
I'm a bit torn. I'm in favor, generally, of people getting more information. This is an item of information. The problem is it's sort of irrelevant information. Should we be promoting consumer reliance on information that really has no bearing on whether the product is safe or not? That's the problem I have with labeling, that, yeah, it provides information. It provides information that clearly some people want because there's a push to have these products labeled. On the other hand, if we had labeling that indicated it was, let's say, produced by union workers as opposed to non-union workers or whatever, you know, you have something in the store that says this is produced by union workers and the federal law, you know, says it's required that you put that on there. Is that something we want the federal government to mandate? Some people might think that's relevant, whether it's produced by union workers or not. It's supposed to be a big into labor solidarity. But does it really affect the quality of the product? And one can think of other things. I mean, I would prefer to stick with labeling if you're talking about food that is directly tied to the nutritional value of the food. And also, if there's some risk, as I said, obviously products that people can be allergic to, those type of things should be listed. But if something is essentially passing on information that has no relevance to the safety of the product, do we want to do that? Do we want to create that precedent?
This is Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is lawyer and philosopher Ronald A. Lindsay, president and CEO of the Center for Inquiry and author of Future Bioethics. Okay, last example, smart drugs. I personally find this one the most fascinating. So maybe just give us a very brief explanation of what smart drugs are.
In recent decades, there have been certain pharmacological products that have been developed, not necessarily intentionally to increase cognitive capacity, but it turns out they have the side effect of increasing certain cognitive capacities, such as alertness. Ritalin is one example used for hyperactive children, but also has the side effect of, at least in some people, enhancing their ability to focus or concentrate. And there are other drugs along these lines that are in various stages of being tested, usually for purposes, again, not necessarily related to creating more cognitive capacities, but they have that effect. And then there are steps now being taken in research to find drugs that may, in fact, increase cognitive capacity. There are things on the market now that may, in fact, affect certain capacities. It's kind of wrong to say they affect intelligence overall, because intelligence is really an array of different skills, but they affect certain aspects of one's ability to carry out certain tasks, one's cognition. The question is, one of the questions is, should these become widely available? And especially, should these be intentionally developed? Should we develop drugs that, in fact, will increase different cognitive capacities? If so, how might they be regulated? Should they become simply regulated by the market, which might mean that people who have more money would have access to them as opposed to less fortunate individuals, economically fortunate individuals? Are they just too dangerous to use altogether? Are they going to upset the balance of society? Or are we going to have maybe some super smart people? So there's a nice range of ethical issues to be considered with smart drugs, which essentially is a wide term for pharmacological products that will affect someone's cognition by making them have certain skills they may otherwise not have.
Well, now what's the line between an enhancement and a therapy? Because there's very different responses to those kinds of things, but it feels like the line is very gray.
Therapy is something that is supposed to remedy or cure a deficiency that someone has. Let's say you're diabetic, right? Which is considered a disease because it limits you in certain ways. You can't do the same things as people who don't have diabetes can do. Now there are ways to help control that. Not necessarily cure it, but, you can have insulin injections and other types of therapies, using that term. Things that will improve your condition in such a way that your range of capacities is similar to what other people have who don't have diabetes. That seems like a pretty clear example. An enhancement would be something that gives you abilities beyond what people normally would have. You know, most people don't have an IQ of 190 or 200. You could come up perhaps with a smart drug that, in fact, taken over a period of time, maybe will give you an IQ of that sort. Most people don't have the ability to stay awake and alert for 48 hours at a time. There are drugs, might be drugs available right now, military might have them, that would allow people to have that capacity. Because that's something that people normally wouldn't have, that's considered an enhancement. So that's a rough and ready distinction, but obviously there are going to be gray areas where it would be hard to distinguish between, you know, a therapy and an enhancement. And the interesting thing, of course, is that some drugs, we're seeing this now with drugs that are in development for Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's obviously affects memory of individuals. So there are drugs being developed that will help improve the memory of individuals. The idea being that this is a therapy for Alzheimer's and will ameliorate some of the symptoms of Alzheimer's patients. But the same sort of drug could also enhance the capacity for memory of a normal individual, someone who's not suffering from Alzheimer's. So the same drug could be both a therapy and an enhancement depending on its use. So that's another case where it's fuzzy.
Does it really come down to then that one is necessary and one is cheating?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's cheating. Let's just take it, enhancements in general. Is it a bad thing to improve one's intelligence? Leave aside, you know, there's a special case of competitions, athletic competitions, and we're reminded of that, of course, by the recent events involving Lance Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
And one can say that in sports competitions, one of the ideas behind the competition is that the so-called level playing field, because it's no fun. The idea of a contest somehow is taken away or diminished if one person in the contest or one team in the contest has such an advantage that it's not really a competition anymore. I mean, you know, no one wants to see the New England Patriots play some Pop Warner team, right, composed of, you know, people who are 6 or 7 years old. But that's an artificial creation. We create these arenas, whether it's bicycling or football or something else, where we want people to be not to have what we regard as an unfair advantage. But in life in general, would it be a bad thing if people were more intelligent, if they had better memories, if they could be more alert? And if so, why is that a bad thing? It seems that counterintuitive to say, well, that's a bad thing, because normally we try to do what we can to improve our intelligence. You know, we try to educate ourselves, we perhaps pursue higher education. There are certain techniques that people use to improve their memory. So it would seem to me that it's actually a very strong argument that if there's a smart drug available, that's not a bad thing.
One of the biggest concerns about pharmacological enhancements, and I guess even genetic enhancements, is that access to them will be unequal.
Yes, that is a big concern. And I think it's a legitimate concern. In general, I just said it doesn't seem that it's a bad thing to have a drug that would make it smarter. One concern would be, well, what if it only makes a minority of individuals smarter, and we create kind of a super class of super smart individuals that would just exacerbate existing inequalities? Because again, if these drugs are being produced by private drug companies, and currently that's the model, at least in the United States, and these are the companies that are pursuing these types of drugs, they're likely probably not going to be covered by health insurance, one would think. That's a whole other issue that we would have to consider. Now, if that's the case, to acquire these drugs is probably going to take a lot of money. So if you're making millions of dollars a year, maybe you can acquire some drug that will make you super smart, but that's not going to be available to the ordinary individual. That would seem to actually make the inequalities we already have much worse. So that is an issue that has to be faced. But I think the answer to that would not be to ban enhancements totally, but rather to regulate them in such a fashion that their distribution would not be restricted simply to a small class of individuals. Now, of course, the counter argument to that is, well, they pose such a danger and, you know, there's going to be a black market. You can't, you know, regulate them completely. Some people can get access. Again, at this stage, that's all speculation. You can't dismiss those arguments out of hand, but I think you'd have to have a very strong argument to say that we should at least explore the possibility of developing drugs that would increase our capacities. Because again, it seems to be a good thing. And if you think about it, throughout most of human existence, we have been increasing our capacities. We've been changing our nature. One example I like to give is the development of literacy. Reading and writing actually changes one's brain structure. I mean, scientists have studied that. They've studied human beings who don't have literate capacity, studied the brains of humans who do, and there are distinct structures in the brain, distinct neuronal patterns that are associated with literacy. So this is something that we have done to ourselves by learning how to read and write, and it's greatly enhanced our cognitive abilities, I think, for the good. Now, fortunately, that was an enhancement that became widely available, and therefore there was no, subset of individuals that, at least for most of our history, dominated because they had access to reading and writing, although for certain periods of time, that was the case.
You actually said something that I laughed out loud at while I was reading. You said that basically if we're so concerned about the potential economic inequality that could arise from pharmacological enhancements, that maybe we could take that on now in other areas, really.
Well, that's true. I think it is a legitimate concern to be worried about the inequalities that may be exacerbated by enhancements. But if we are that concerned about it, why not eliminate those inequalities now? Because again, the argument is, well, the rich, they're going to have access to these smart drugs, middle class and poor people won't. Well, why don't you take that step further and say, if in fact being rich gives you so much power and the ability to dominate others, maybe we should do something to try to at least diminish those inequalities now. And I think a strong argument could be made for that.
Ron, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being here, and thank you for your perspective on this.
Well, thanks a lot. I enjoyed the conversation.
You can find links to Ron Lindsay and the Center for Inquiry on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Now, we thought that after talking about the ethical considerations around smart drugs, that you might be interested in the science behind them. We'll be back with Dr. Rob Tarswell to discuss nootropics and the pharmaceutical enhancement of intelligence after these messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're pouring over the science of that most beloved beverage, beer. Guest host Rochelle Saunders talks to Dr. Charlie Bamforth, professor of malting and brewing sciences at UC Davis. We'll take an in-depth look at the chemistry of the brewing process and everything from flavor to foam. And Dr. Rob Tarswell explains why an effective hangover cure continues to elude us. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm Desiree Schell, here with Dr. Robert Tarswell. Rob is a clinical assistant professor on the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia. He has a dual specialty in nuclear medicine and psychiatry. Welcome back, Dr. Rob.
Thanks for having me back.
So tell us about smart drugs, sir. What are they?
Well, the basic idea was coined for the term nootropics. N-O-O-tropics was coined back in the early 70s. The idea being, can we pharmacologically hack the brain to get increased cognitive performance out of it? So can we get improved alertness, attention, recall, memory, computation, creativity? There's no real specific drugs that aim at enhancing cognitive skill because most drugs are developed to target diseases. But where you find the use of nootropics would be taking a compound that might be effective, such as, say, stimulants for ADHD, where we can boost the attention of somebody who's very inattentive, and then maybe trying that with somebody who has a normal level of attention and alertness to see if we can expand that.
Were these discovered by accident as sort of side effects of medications used for other reasons then?
I wouldn't say that. I think there's probably been a long history in the idea of at least some kind of altered states, probably going back as far as the history of alcohol, which would be the psychotropic that we have at least the longest historical records for. Or another one would be, say, tobacco, nicotine, widely known to improve alertness in users, at least in the early stages. In terms of there being a specific effort to find and exploit pharmacologic strategies, I'm not aware of anything specific, but certainly there have been informal or even anecdotal efforts essentially from the dawn of history.
So what exactly do they do physically?
Well, the most common one that you will run it into would be the use of stimulants, especially an expanded use in college students. So stimulants were first discovered to have efficacy in keeping pilots alert in the Second World War, and lots of pilots for night flying raids would be given methylphenidate or dexedrin to keep them awake and alert on a long night bombing raid. Then they'd be given downers to help them sleep when they got back. And eventually, individuals with what came to be known as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder were found to improve remarkably when treated with psychostimulants. So it's not too many leaps for someone to say, well, gee, I wonder if I would be more alert and attentive taking psychostimulants. And indeed, that can happen, which is why the usage rates of psychostimulants now by college students on North American campuses are estimated to be anywhere between 7 and 27%.
So they do work.
They sort of work in the same way that alcohol works or cigarettes work. You can start taking stimulants, and initially you will have the concentration of a laser beam. It's lovely. What ends up happening, though, of course, is your brain, being an adaptive system, always tries to get back to an equilibrium. So the basic pharmacologic mechanism of psychostimulants is to flood your frontal cortex with dopamine, either by causing more release or by blocking it from being taken back up by neurons and broken down. What ends up happening, though, is your brain says, wow, there's a lot of dopamine around all the time. I better cut back on my ability to pick up dopamine signals. So your brain starts to downregulate dopamine receptors on the other side of the synapse. The magical effect of the medication starts to wear off. So, well, what do? Well, you take more. And here's the tried and true path of anyone who's ever chased any kind of a dragon. And after that, you're heading into the land of other kinds of dragons. You're heading into areas where we really don't have much in the way of science or experience to guide you.
Well, let's talk about some of those.
I was on call over Christmas and was asked to assess a young man who was actually at the emergency department on his own because he wanted to talk to a doctor about gang stalking. And the emergency physician quickly surmised that the young chap was unwell and referred him my way. And he said, yeah, you know, I've been reading on the internet that it is possible for gangs to stalk people. They can plant cameras in your house and even have cars waiting for you on the street. And there can be up to hundreds of people in these gangs. And they were following me around at the university, and I could tell from the way they were looking at me, and he was speaking about this quickly. And I sort of stepped back and asked him, so, you know, tell me a bit about college life. And he was in his first semester at university in a province which shall go unnamed. And he was having trouble keeping up with his schoolwork. So he went to the ever helpful campus health clinic, which shall also go unnamed, but is in my bad books. And managed to fake symptoms of ADHD in a 10-minute interview, and bam, got himself a prescription for Ritalin. And within about two or three months, managed to have himself quite a raging stimulant addiction on his hands. And then about 3 weeks later, had quite a raging stimulant-induced psychosis on his hands. But he had lost insight into his psychotic state, and in a state of absolute terror that he was being stalked by some unknown gang with nefarious intent, randomly bought an airline ticket and got on a flight home just before his final exams, completely lost this, and ended up being admitted to hospital until he dried out
That's something as simple as Ritalin, and that's something that we don't necessarily think of as a smart drug. So what else is sort of in development, or what are we seeing?
There's no specific development going after healthy individuals. It's really taking drugs used for disease indications and trying them out in human beings, which is sort of the major driver of it. All other psychostimulants have been tried by individuals for these kinds of effects. In some senses, this can be done in a clinically supervised and monitored way. Even nowadays, there will be, in some instances, long-haul pilots on overnight flights who, under the supervision of a physician, may at times use something called Allertec, mild stimulants to maintain alertness, maintain sharpness. And they're used in a very limited and controlled fashion, and that can be really helpful because, say, here's an individual who has normal physiology, normal psychology, but is put in an abnormal situation, shift work overnight, with the stakes of error being quite high. And, well, can we reduce those stakes with pharmacology? Well, maybe we can. Other categories of drugs which have been tried would include things like the cholinesterase inhibitors, and those are drugs that basically try to increase acetylcholine in your brain, which is implicated in long-term memory. So this would be medications like Aricept, which is used in Alzheimer's disease early on to try and slow the progression of dementia. The thought is, can we enhance memory in an individual who has normal memory through the use of something like that? The data aren't terribly convincing and aren't terribly clear. And of course, like any other medication, there's always side effects to contend with. Maybe not necessarily as spectacular as psychosis, which requires admission to a hospital and involves cross-continent plane rides, but certainly you can get yourself into all kinds of trouble anyway.
So I think regardless of what the regulations turn out to be around these specific medications, they are going to find their way to the public. So where do you think this is headed then?
We are watching the natural unfolding of this stimulant use in a widespread way on university campuses. What will the spawn of that be? I don't know. There'll also even be the question of what is the role of the physician in all this? What is the role of a medical practitioner? When somebody comes into the office, maybe not necessarily with a medical complaint, but is interested in what you could call cosmetic pharmacology. I want some enhancements, doc. What can you hook me up with? It's a bit like the psychiatric version of plastic surgery clinic.
Do you think at this point there's any way to do it right? In your ideal world, knowing that people are going to be pursuing these kinds of pharmacological enhancements, where do we go?
A good place to start would be to at least have an honest conversation with a prescriber and not go in and lie about ADHD symptoms in order to get stimulants. You could go in and say to your doctor, you know, look, I've got some major projects coming up. I need more wakefulness. I need more alertness. I've got to get through this 200,000 word thesis. Can we try something on a limited basis under supervision? Well, you know, maybe there's a role for that. This is an issue that sort of touches on regulations, ethics, and so forth, way beyond anything that I understand, beyond a superficial level. But if somebody was to approach me, I don't know if I'd necessarily pull out my prescription pad, but I would at least maybe open up a discussion about, wow, sounds like you're up to your neck in obligations. How did this happen? Can we look at this? Can we address the underlying issue? But I'm a psychiatrist. I have the time to do that. Maybe family doctors don't. So on the other hand, the unnamed medical clinic that is constantly getting students coming in pleading that they've got ADHD, maybe the family doctors there are just doing the best they can in 10-minute appointments to try and figure out who's lying, who's not. And, you know, doctors aren't lie detectors. I don't answer your question, did I?
I didn't expect you could. That was a nice exploration of potentials, really. And this is a really complicated issue. In my interview with Ron Lindsay that happened right before this one, it's obvious that exactly what you're talking about, that we need to actually open up a dialogue if we're going to get anywhere with this at all. But before you leave, I wanted to ask you one more thing. And sure. It's not about nootropics at all. It's about your new project, the 1 Minute Medical School. Tell us about that.
Well, this is something I've wanted to do for about a year. And the idea is short videos about various medical topics aimed at an interested public audience who has at least a little bit of scientific education. Because there's a lot of incredibly bad medical information on the internet.
Fascinating.
So I thought, all right, what would it look like if I could try and bring just genuine medical knowledge, but sort of stripped down to a very basic level, but is still actually substantive, and package it up in 1 minute videos so that people's attention is maintained throughout the video and they go away feeling like they've got a substantive nugget, but they haven't sat there through a 1 hour slogging, horrible lecture. I find that when I teach residents and medical students, I often have a pen in my hand and I'm using mnemonics or I'm making little drawings. And I initially had talked to a couple friends of mine who are animators, but they're busy actually working as animators to help me with my pet project. So I said, okay, what if I draw and write very slowly so that it's neat and readable, and then just speed up the video and talk over top of it? And bam, we have this kind of crazy mashup of Minute Physics, Khan Academy, and RSA Animate, and out of it pops 1 Minute Medical School.
It is great. What types of topics have you covered so far?
I have done the interaction of radiation with DNA. I talked about a suicide assessment shortly after we learned about the sad and really way too early, way too tragic loss of Aaron Swartz of Reddit fame, although he didn't actually co-found it, but who did actually create the RSS protocol in Creative Commons and was an internet activist. And it was a real punch in the gut. So that sort of sparked a suicide assessment video. I've got a series of videos that I've partially released and I'm still putting together on the immune system. Mm-hmm. It seems that there is no more absolutely plague of terrible information on the internet than around immunity. So few people are talking about, well, what are just the basics of immunity? How does it actually work? Well, I shouldn't say so few people are talking about it. There are lots and lots of videos about immunity. A lot of them are pitched at an incredibly high level. I'm trying, again, to package up concepts of immunity, 1 minute bites, so people can come away with a sense of, hey, what this actually is, what it actually involves, how it actually works. And that's going to lead, I hope, down the road into a series on vaccination. I also, of course, want to roll out a whole bunch of topics in psychiatry. But it's going to be a lot of topics across the broad fields of medicine.
Are you taking requests? That's what I was wondering.
I am taking requests. I actually have somewhere on my desk a list of viewer requests, and I've already put up a viewer-requested topic on herd immunity. Yeah, I've had viewer-requested video that I've produced in anaphylaxis, and I've got all kinds of requests. So somebody wants to know about norovirus. Somebody wants to know how EpiPen works. Somebody wants me to talk about the vaccine autism controversy, hereditary diseases.
In 1 minute?
Minute, yeah. I've even had a secret confession request from a doctor who said, you know, I know how to read EKGs, but I don't know why that thing deflects up and down. I've never... Why does that do that? Can you... You about that?
Wow.
Yeah. Somebody wants to know if there's any fibromyalgia breakthrough research. That is going to be 1 second medical school. Spoiler alert, no. The requests keep coming in.
So if somebody actually has a request, what should they do?
They could email me at 1minutemedicalschool@gmail.com.
Rob, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You can find a link to Dr. Rob Tarswell's 1 Minute Medical School on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our studio assistants are Helen Cavillion and Chelsea Butler. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell. This episode was edited by lead technician Ryan Bromsgrove.